An omniscient God, such as the Orthodox believe in, must now know the whole course of the future. There is, therefore, if an omniscient God exists, a present fact, namely, his foreknowledge, from which the future could be inferred. This, however, lies outside what can be scientifically tested. If this doctrine of determinism is to assert anything that can be made probable or improbable by evidence, it must be stated in relation to our human powers. If we are to have a doctrine that can be tested, it is not enough to say that the whole course of nature must be determined by causal laws. This might be true, and yet undiscoverable. For example, if what is more distant had more effect than what is nearer, for we should then need a detailed knowledge of the most distant stars before we could foresee what was going to happen on Earth. If we are to be able to test our doctrine, we must be able to state it in relation to a finite part of the universe, and the laws must be sufficiently simple for us to be able to make calculations by their means. We cannot know the whole universe, and we cannot test laws which are so complicated as to require more skill than we can hope to possess for the working out of their consequences. The powers of calculation involved may exceed what is possible at the moment, but not what may probably be acquired before long. This point is fairly obvious, but there is more difficulty in stating our principle so as to be applicable when our data are confined to a finite part of the universe. Things from outside may always crash in and have unexpected effects. Sometimes a new star appears in the heavens, and these appearances cannot be predicted from the data confined to the solar system. And as nothing travels faster than light, there is no way by which we can get an advance message telling that a new star is going to appear. For the first time in history, determinism is now being challenged on scientific grounds. The challenge has come through the study of the atom by the new methods of quantum mechanics. According to quantum mechanics, it cannot be known what an atom will do in given circumstances. There are a definite set of alternatives open to it, and it chooses sometimes one, sometimes another. We know in what proportion of cases one choice will be made, in what proportion a second or a third, and so on. But we do not know any law determining the choice in an individual instance. No one can deny that laws may be discovered which will show why an atom chooses one possibility on one occasion and another on another. At present, we know of no relevant difference in the antecedents of the two different choices, but some such difference may be found any day. If we had any strong reason to believe in determinism, this argument would carry great weight. Unfortunately for the determinists, there is a further step in the modern doctrine of atomic caprice. We had, or so we thought, a great mass of evidence from ordinary physics tending to prove that bodies always move in accordance with laws which completely determine what they will do. It now appears that all these laws may be merely statistical. The atoms choose among possibilities in certain proportions, and they are so numerous that the result, as regards bodies large enough to be observed by old-fashioned methods, has an appearance of complete regularity. Suppose you were a giant who could not see individual people and never became aware of an aggregate of less than a million of them. You would just be able to notice that London contains more matter by day than by night. But you could not possibly be aware of the fact that on a given day, Mr. Dixon was ill in bed and did not take his usual train. You would therefore believe the movement of matter into London in the morning and out of it in the evening to be a much more regular affair than it is. You would no doubt attribute it to some peculiar force in the sun, a hypothesis which would be confirmed by the observation that the movement is retarded in foggy weather. If later you became able to observe individual people, you would find that there is less regularity than you had supposed. One day Mr. Dixon is ill, and another Mr. Simpson. The statistical average is not affected, and to a large-scale observation there is no difference. You would find that all the regularity you had previously observed could be accounted for by the statistical law of large numbers, without supposing that Mr. Dixon and Mr. Simpson had any reason beyond caprice for their occasional failure to go to London in the morning. This is exactly the situation at which physics has arrived in regard to atoms. It does not know of any laws completely determining their behavior, and the statistical laws which it has discovered are sufficient to account for the observed regularity and the motions of large bodies. And as the case for determinism has rested on these, it seems to have broken down. What quantum theory assumes as regards individual atoms is a law of probability. Of the possible choices open to the atom, there is a known probability of one, another known probability of a second, and so on. From this law of probability, it can be inferred that large bodies are almost certain to behave as traditional mechanics expect. The observed regularity of large bodies, therefore, is only probable and approximate, and affords no inductive ground for expecting a perfect regularity in the doings of individual people. What is new in quantum mechanics is not the occurrence of statistical laws, but the suggestion that they are ultimate, instead of being derived from laws governing individual occurrences. This is a very difficult conception, more difficult, I think, than its supporters realize. It has been observed that, of the different things an atom may do, it does each a certain proportion of cases. But if the single atom is lawless, why should there be this regularity as regards large numbers? There must, one would suppose, be something that makes the rare transitions depend upon some unusual set of circumstances. Now, the laws of large-scale mechanics, as we have seen, are unchanged by the new theories as to the atom. The only difference is that they now state overwhelming probabilities instead of certainties. It is possible to imagine these probabilities counteracted by some peculiar kind of instability, owing to which a very small force might produce a very large effect. This sort of instability may exist in living matter, and more particularly in the brain. An act of volition may lead one atom to this choice rather than that, which may upset some very delicate balance, and so produce a large-scale result, such as saying one thing rather than another. It cannot be denied that this is abstractly possible, but that is the most that can be conceded. It is also a possibility, and to my mind a much more probable one, that new laws will be discovered which will abolish the supposed freedom of the atom. And even granting the freedom of the atom, there is no empirical evidence that large-scale movements of human bodies are exempt from the process of averaging, which makes traditional mechanics applicable to the movements of other bodies of appreciable size. The search for causal laws, as we saw, is the essence of science. And therefore, in a purely practical sense, the person of science must always assume determinism as a working hypothesis. But he is not bound to assert that there are causal laws except where he has actually found them. Indeed, he is unwise if he does so. But he is still more unwise if he asserts positively that he knows of a region where causal laws do not operate. This assertion has an unwisdom at once theoretical and practical. Theoretical, because our knowledge can never be sufficient to warrant such an assertion. And practical, because the belief that there are no causal laws in a certain province discourages investigation and may prevent laws from being discovered. This double unwisdom seems to me to belong both to those who assert that changes in atoms are not completely deterministic and to those who dogmatically assert free will. Faced with such opposite dogmatisms, science should remain purely empirical, carrying neither assertion nor denial beyond the point warranted by actual evidence. Perennial controversies, such as that between determinism and free will, arise from the conflict of two strong but logically irreconcilable passions. Determinism has the advantage that power comes through the discovery of causal laws. Science, in spite of its conflict with theological prejudice, has been accepted because it gave power. Belief that the course of nature is regular also gives a sense of security. It enables us, up to a point, to foresee the future and to prevent unpleasant occurrences. When illness and storms were attributed to capricious, diabolical agencies, they were much more terrifying than they are now. all these motives lead people to determinism. But while they like to have power over nature, they do not like nature to have power over them. If they are obliged to believe that before the human race existed, laws were at work which, by a kind of blind necessity, produced not only people in general, but oneself with all one's idiosyncrasies, saying and doing at this moment whatever one is saying and doing, they feel robbed of personality, futile, unimportant, the slaves of circumstance, unable to vary in the slightest degree the part assigned to them by nature from the very beginning. From this dilemma, some people seek to escape by assuming freedom in human beings and determinism everywhere else. Others, by ingeniously sophisticated attempts at a logical reconciliation of freedom with determinism. In fact, we have no reason to adopt either alternative, but we also have no reason to suppose that the truth, whatever it may be, is such as to combine the agreeable features of both, or is, in any degree, determinable by relation to our desires. Science and ethics. Those who maintain the insufficiency of science appeal to the fact that science has nothing to say about value. As there is no consensus of opinion about ethics, it must be understood that what follows is my personal belief, not the dictum of science. The study of ethics traditionally consists of two parts, one concerned with moral rules, the other with what is good on its own account. Rules of conduct, many of which have a ritual origin, play a great part in the lives of all peoples. Rules, such as the prohibition of murder and theft, have an obvious social utility and survive the decay of the theological systems with which they were originally associated. But as people grow more reflective, there is a tendency to lay less stress on rules and more on states of mind. This comes from two sources, philosophy and mystical religion. What they value is a state of mind, out of which, as they hold, right conduct must ensue. Rules seem to them external and insufficiently adaptable to circumstances. One of the ways in which the need of appealing to external rules of conduct has been avoided has been the belief in conscience. It has been supposed that God reveals to each human heart what is right and what is wrong, so that, in order to avoid sin, we have only to listen to the inner voice. There are, however, two difficulties in the theory. First, that conscience says different things to different people. Secondly, that the study of the unconscious has given us an understanding of the mundane causes of conscientious feelings. The diversity and the deliverances of conscience is what is to be expected when its origin is understood. In early youth, certain classes of acts meet with approval and others with disapproval, and by the normal process of association, pleasure and discomfort gradually attach themselves to the acts and not merely to the approval and disapproval respectively produced by them. As time goes on, we may forget all about our early moral training, but we shall still feel uncomfortable about certain kinds of actions, while others will give us a glow of virtue. To introspection, these feelings are mysterious, since we no longer remember the circumstances which originally caused them. And therefore it is natural to attribute them to the voice of God in the heart. But in fact, conscience is a product of education and can be trained to approve or disapprove, in the great majority of cases, as educators see fit. While, therefore, it is right to wish to liberate ethics from external moral rules, this can hardly be satisfactorily achieved by means of the notion of conscience. Questions as to values, that is to say, as to what is good or bad on its own account, independently of its effects, lie outside the domain of science, as the defenders of religion emphatically assert. I think that in this they are right, but I draw the further conclusion, which they do not draw, that questions as to values lie wholly outside the domain of knowledge. That is to say, when we assert that this or that has value, we are giving expression to our own emotions, not to a fact, which would still be true if our personal feelings were different. It is obvious, to begin with, that the whole idea of good and bad has some connection with desire. Anything that we all desire is good, and anything that we all dread is bad. If we all agreed in our desires, the matter could be left there. But unfortunately, our desires conflict. If I say, what I want is good, my neighbor will say, no, what I want is good. Ethics is an attempt, though not, I think, a successful one, to escape from this subjectivity. I shall naturally try to show, in my dispute with my neighbor, that my desires have some quality which makes them more worthy of respect than his. Ethics is an attempt to give universal, and not merely personal, importance to certain of our desires. Ethics contains no statements, whether true or false, but consists of desires of a certain general kind, namely such as are concerned with the desires of humankind in general. Science can discuss the causes of desires and the means for realizing them, but it cannot contain any genuinely ethical sentences because it is concerned with what is true or false. The theory I have been advocating is a form of the doctrine which is called the subjectivity of values. This doctrine consists in maintaining that if two people differ about values, there is not a disagreement as to any kind of truth, but a difference of taste. The consequences of this doctrine are considerable. In the first place, there can be no such thing as sin in any absolute sense. What one person calls sin, another may call virtue. And though they may dislike each other on account of this difference, neither can convict the other of intellectual error. Punishment cannot be justified on the ground that the criminal is wicked, but only on the ground that he has behaved in a way which others wish to discourage. Hell, as a place of punishment for sinners, becomes quite irrational. The more general consequences which are feared, such as the decay of all sense of moral obligation, are to be logically deduced. Moral obligation, if it is to influence conduct, must consist not merely of a belief, but of a desire. Such desires can, no doubt, be encouraged by example, education, and knowledge. But they can hardly be created by the mere abstract belief that they are good, nor discouraged by an analysis of what is meant by the word good. When we contemplate the human species, we may desire that it should be happy, or healthy, or intelligent, or warlike, and so on. Any one of these desires, if it is strong, will produce its own morality. But if we have no such general desires, our conduct, whatever our ethic may be, will only serve social purposes insofar as self-interest and the interests of the society are in harmony. It is the business of wise institutions to create such harmony as far as possible. And for the rest, whatever may be our theoretical definition of value, we must depend upon the existence of impersonal desires. Our desires are, in fact, more general and less purely selfish than many moralists imagine. If it were not so, no theory of ethics would make moral improvement possible. It is, in fact, not by ethical theory, but by the cultivation of large and generous desires through intelligence, happiness, and freedom from fear, that people can be brought to act more than they do at present, in a manner that is consistent with the general happiness of humankind. Whatever our definition of the good, and whether we believe it to be subjective or objective, those who do not desire the happiness of humanity will not endeavour to further it, while those who do desire it will do what they can to bring it about. The scientific temper of mind is cautious, tentative, and piecemeal. It does not imagine that it knows the whole truth, or that even its best knowledge is wholly true. It knows that every doctrine needs emendation sooner or later, and that the necessary emendation requires freedom of investigation and freedom of discussion. But out of theoretical science, a scientific technique has developed, and the scientific technique has none of the tentativeness of a theory. Physics has been revolutionized during the present century by relativity and the quantum theory. But all inventions based upon the old physics are still found satisfactory. The practical experts who employ scientific technique, and still more the governments and large firms which employ the practical experts, acquire a quite different temper from that of the scientists, a temper full of a sense of limitless power, of arrogant certainty, and of pleasure in manipulation. This is the very reverse of the scientific temper, but it cannot be denied that science has helped to promote it. The direct effects of scientific technique have been by no means wholly beneficial. On the one hand, they have increased the destructiveness of weapons of war. On the other hand, by increasing the productivity of labor, they have made the old economic system, which depended upon scarcity, very difficult to work with. And by the violent impact of new ideas, they have thrown ancient civilizations off their balance. The warfare between science and theology, in spite of an occasional skirmish on the outposts, is nearly ended. And I think most religious people would admit that their religion is the better for it. Christianity has been purified of inessentials inherited from a barbarous age, and nearly cured of the desire to persecute. But while the older religions have thus become purified, and in many ways beneficial, new religions have arisen, with all the persecuting zeal, and with as great a readiness to oppose science as characterized by the Inquisition. The persecution of intellectuals by totalitarian regimes has surpassed, in severity, anything perpetrated by the churches during the last 250 years. It may be urged that persecution in our day, unlike the past, is political and economic rather than theological. But such a plea would be unhistorical. Economic and political motives have always been a part cause of persecution, perhaps even the main cause. In any case, the argument against the persecution of opinion does not depend upon what the excuse for persecution may be. The argument is that we none of us know all truth, that the discovery of new truth is promoted by free discussion and rendered very difficult by suppression, and that in the long run human welfare is increased by the discovery of truth and hindered by action based on error. New truth is often inconvenient to some vested interest, but it is in the interest of the community at large that new truth should be freely promulgated. Those to whom intellectual freedom is personally important may be a minority in the community, but among them are the people of most importance to the future. New truth is often uncomfortable, especially to the holders of power. Nevertheless, amid the long record of cruelty and bigotry, it is the most important achievement of our intelligent but wayward species. Science and education. Science, to the ordinary reader of newspapers, is represented by a varying selection of sensational triumphs. It is not of this aspect of science that I wish to speak. Science in this aspect consists of detached, up-to-date fragments, interesting only until they are replaced by something newer and more up-to-date, displaying nothing of the systems of patiently constructed knowledge out of which, almost as a casual incident, have come the practically useful results which interest the general public. The increased command over the forces of nature, which is derived from science, is undoubtedly an amply sufficient reason for encouraging scientific research, but this reason has been so often urged and is so easily appreciated that other reasons, to my mind quite as important, are apt to be overlooked. It is with these other reasons, especially with the intrinsic value of a scientific habit of mind in forming our outlook on the world, that I shall be concerned in what follows. In the broader sense, education will include not only what we learn through instruction, but all that we learn through personal experience, the formation of character through the education of life. In the narrower sense, education may be confined to instruction, the imparting of definite information on various subjects, because such information in and for itself is useful in daily life. But instruction, necessary as it is, does not per se constitute education in the sense in which I wish to consider it. Education, in the sense in which I mean it, may be defined as the formation, by means of instruction, of certain mental habits and a certain outlook of life and the world. It remains to ask ourselves what mental habits and what sort of outlook can be hoped for as a result of instruction. When we have answered this question, we can attempt to decide what science has to contribute to the formation of the habits and outlook which we desire. Our whole life is built about a certain number, not a very small number, of primary instincts and impulses. Only what is in some way connected with these instincts and impulses appears to us desirable or important. There is no faculty, whether reason or virtue, or whatever it may be called, that can take our active life and our hopes and fears outside the region controlled by these first movers of all desire. All meaning must be at bottom related to our primary desires, and when they are extinct, no miracle can restore to the world the value which they reflected upon it. The purpose of education, therefore, cannot be to create any primary impulse which is lacking in the uneducated. The purpose can only be to enlarge the scope of those that human nature provided, by increasing the number and variety of attendant thoughts, and by showing where the most permanent satisfaction is to be found. But although nature must supply the initial force of desire, nature is not, in the civilized person, the spasmodic, fragmentary, and yet violent set of impulses that it can be in the uncivilized person. Each impulse has its constitutional ministry of thought and knowledge and reflection, through which possible conflicts of impulses are foreseen. Temporary impulses are controlled by the unifying impulse which may be called wisdom. In this way, education destroys the crudity of instinct and increases, through knowledge, the wealth and variety of the individual's contacts with the world, making him no longer an isolated fighting unit, but a citizen of the universe, embracing remote regions of space and vast stretches of past and future within the circle of his interests. It is this simultaneous softening of the insistence of desire and enlargement of its scope that is the chief moral end of education. Closely connected with this moral end is the purely intellectual aim of education, the endeavor to make us see and imagine the world in an objective manner, as far as possible as it is in itself, and not merely through the distorting medium of personal desire. The complete attainment of such an objective view is no doubt an ideal, indefinitely approachable, but not actually and fully realizable. Education, considered as a process of forming our mental habits and our outlook on the world, is to be judged successful in proportion as its outcome approximates to this ideal. If this standard is admitted, we can return to the consideration of science, inquiring how far science contributes to such an aim, and whether it is in any respect superior to other educational practices. The discovery of scientific method has already transformed the world, and its success proceeds with ever-accelerating velocity. No transcendent ability is required in order to make useful discoveries in science. The edifice of science needs its masons, bricklayers, and common laborers, as well as its foremen, master builders, and architects. In science, even a very moderate capacity can contribute to a supreme achievement. In science, the person of real genius is the person who invents a new method. The notable discoveries are often made by the successors, who can apply the method with fresh vigor, unimpaired by the previous labor of perfecting it. But the mental caliber of the thought required for their work, however brilliant, is not so great as that required by the first inventor of the method. There are in science immense numbers of different methods, appropriate to different classes of problems, but over and above them all, there is something so easily definable, which may be called the method of science. It was formerly customary to identify this with the inductive method, but the true method of science is something which includes deduction as much as induction, logic and mathematics as much as botany and geology. The kernel of the scientific outlook is a thing so simple, so obvious, so seemingly trivial, that the mention of it may almost excite derision. The kernel of the scientific outlook is the refusal to regard our own desires, tastes, and interests as affording a key to the understanding of the world. Stated thus baldly, this may seem no more than a trite truism. But to remember it consistently in matters arousing our passionate partisanship is by no means easy, especially where the available evidence is uncertain and inconclusive. Aristotle considered that the stars must move in circles because the circle is the most perfect curve. In the absence of evidence to the contrary, he allowed himself to decide a question of fact by appeal to aesthetico-moral considerations. In such a case, it is at once obvious to us that this appeal was unjustifiable. We know now how to ascertain as a fact the way in which the heavenly bodies move, and we know that they do not move in circles, or even in accurate ellipses, or in any other kind of simply describable curve. This may be painful to a certain hankering after simplicity of pattern in the universe, but we know that in astronomy such feelings are irrelevant. Easy as this knowledge seems now, we owe it to the courage and insight of the first inventors of scientific method, and more especially to Galileo. Under the influence of Darwinism, the scientific attitude towards humanity has now become fairly common, and is to some people quite natural, though to most it is still a difficult and artificial contortion. The scientific attitude of mind involves a sweeping away of all other desires in the interests of the desire to know. It involves suppression of hopes and fears, loves and hates, and the whole subjective emotional life, until we become subdued to the material, able to see it frankly, without preconceptions, without bias, without any wish except to see it as it is, and without any belief that what it is must be determined by some relation, positive or negative, to what we should like it to be, or to be what we can easily imagine it to be. A certain self-absorption, not personal, but human, has marked almost all attempts to conceive the universe as a whole. Mind, or some aspect of it, thought, or will, or sentience, has been regarded as the pattern after which the universe is to be conceived, for no better reason at bottom than that such a universe would not seem strange, and would give us the cozy feeling that every place is essentially like home. To conceive the universe as essentially progressive or essentially deteriorating, for example, is to give to our hopes and fears a cosmic importance, which may, of course, be justified. Until we have learned to think of it in ethically neutral terms, we have not arrived at a scientific attitude. The instinct of constructiveness, which is one of the chief incentives to artistic creation, can find in scientific systems a satisfaction more massive than any epic poem. Curiosity, which is the source of almost all intellectual effort, finds with astonished delight that science can unveil secrets which might well have seemed forever undiscoverable. The desire for a larger life and wider interests, for an escape from solitary circumstances, and even from the whole recurring human cycle of birth and death, is fulfilled by the impersonal cosmic outlook of science, as by nothing else. To all these must be added, as contributing to the happiness of the person of science, the admiration of splendid achievement, and the consciousness of inestimable utility to the human species. A life devoted to science is therefore a happy life, and its happiness is derived from the very best sources that are open to dwellers on this troubled and passionate planet. This is David Case for Audio Scholar. Thank you for listening.